She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. Our show today is sponsored by the Fairfax Companies, true leaders in the business of sustainability. And as always, we thank them for their support. And everybody, I am truly excited about my guest today. She is the climate heretic. Her name is Dr. Judith Curry, and she is a professor and former chair of the School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences, at the Georgia Institute of Technology, and president and co-owner of Climate Forecast Applications Network, known as CFAN. She has been known for her work on hurricanes, Arctic ice dynamics, and other climate-related topics. Welcome, Judith. Thank you for taking the time to be with us.
Well, Mrs. Green, it's a real pleasure to be on your show.
You know, I just want to go off the grid a little bit about my thoughts about having you on the show. This is a really complex subject. Climate change, global warming, it elicits fear, it elicits controversy. Sometimes the great divide, it polarizes people. And I talked to you a little bit earlier off air and said, you know, I'm not nervous about the show, but I feel an intense obligation. That's what I finally got in touch with. Because we do want to have fun, but you have put a spin on this that just epitomizes the tagline for my show. We don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And what I hope the outcome of the show is that people really listen to what you have to say and start thinking. So with that introduction on my coming from my very green and committed heart for the planet, you got named the climate heretic, I believe, in an article that was published back in 2010. And it was, and it got my attention. Somebody sent it to me and said, climate heretic. Judith Curry turns on her colleagues. Why can't we have a civil conversation about climate? And after reading it, I immediately emailed Kelly and said, we have to get this woman on the show because I think you're a climate peacemaker, not a climate heretic. So I want to start a new moniker for you. So can you share with us what brought it all about and the kind of the genesis of the article?
Oh, gosh. Well, I have to tell you something funny. I don't know if before I get into that about the article. Following the article, there was such an uproar over it from both sides. It went viral. So Scientific American then had an online survey about climate change, and it included a question, is Judith Curry a dupe or a peacemaker?
You've got to. Oh, I love it.
You know, it was a multiple choice test.
Yes.
And then answer C was, I've never heard of Judith Curry. Fortunately, the peacemaker won over dupe by a long shot. But, you know, but how bizarre can you get where Scientific American is running a survey as Judith Curry, a peacemaker, or a dupe?
A question like that. And then also that I did not read that survey, did not receive the survey, and thought, this woman is far from a heretic. She's asking people to sit down and engage in civilized conversation and address issues that we, the general public, we're the ones that get duped a lot, in my opinion. So, you know, talk to us about the modicum of truth to the detractors, which I, you know, from doing more and more research is growing. Not the detractors, but people that say we need to, like, pump down the volume a little bit on the alarm bell. Why can't scientists sit down and civilly address the issues for all our sakes?
Well, I think you hit on it in some of your introductory comments. You said it's a very complex issue. climate change and its impacts and potential responses is indeed a very complex issue. And my concern is that we've oversimplified both the problem and the potential solutions. And the reason for that is because people adopted, you know, tried to frame this very simply as, you know, that climate change is forced, it's dominated by humans, and that by reducing emissions, we can bring the climate back to some previous state or prevent catastrophic happenings, and that we need to build up a scientific consensus on this topic, which will then lead to a political consensus, which will then lead to action.
Right.
Well, some 20-odd years later, no.
Here we sit.
Here we sit. So this is, the fact that we're not getting any closer to any kind of solution that the advocates for mitigating emissions, you know, have been preaching for, you know, just reflects the complexity of the issue. Scientifically, I'm very concerned that we've sort of forgotten about natural climate variability in the midst of focusing only on human-caused climate change. And there are a lot of wild cards in the climate system, like volcanoes and solar variations.
Right.
And things like that, and the long-term ocean circulations that we don't know how to predict, and whether these are dominant or not in terms of the recent climate variability is something that's hotly debated.
And what you had the nerve to do is bring it up. I mean, and not just bring it up and say, well, is anybody thinking about this, but in very scientific, very thorough, you know, research-based ways, one of the quotes that stood out to me as the, I am the representative of the people. That's what I say. I am John Q. Public that wants to be a well-informed citizen, and that's who listens to my show. What should we be thinking? And a quote you said, although many of the skeptics do recycle critiques that have long since been disproved, others bring up valid points. And you talked about lumping the good with the bad. So as the public, you know, reflection of that, what happens when we lump the good with the bad, especially for the masses? Scientists can figure it out and go on your website and, you know, come up with answers. But what happens when we lump the good with the bad and totally dismiss what the opposition is saying?
Well, it leads to polarization.
Right.
It makes the whole issue even more politically polarized. And then that feeds back onto the science. And the scientists, you know, become polarized, and groupthink sets in, and, you know, all sorts of things that aren't useful for either the science or the policy decisions start to happen. And that's where we're at right now. And what I'm trying to do is protect the integrity of science, which I feel has been rather damaged by all this politicization, and try to open the discussion for a broader range of policy options to deal with climate change, the related environmental effects, responding to severe weather, in a broader way that perhaps doesn't lead to so much political opposition. I mean, everybody can agree that we need to protect ourselves from floods and droughts, for example. Reduce the vulnerability of our water supplies to droughts, reduce our vulnerability to catastrophic flooding.
And
however,
people don't talk about that. I don't mean to interrupt, but go ahead. People don't talk about that as you do. So go ahead. I really didn't mean to interrupt, but it's such a valid point. There are other really good things we could be doing that are going to impact thousands, if not millions, of lives. So go on, flooding.
Well, the most dangerous thing is people think that, well, if we just reduced emissions,
right,
our flooding and drought problems would go away. Well, that's not true at all. It's related to population increase, land use, natural climate variability. I mean, these are the things that are driving our vulnerability to floods and droughts more so than greenhouse gas emissions. And trying to deal with those problems, arguably to me makes more sense than trying to deal with carbon dioxide emissions as a short-term solution, pretending that's a solution for these problems.
And it's almost like the short-term memory of, does anybody remember Hurricane Katrina and what happened in New Orleans and that they lived all those years below sea level and that another really bad thing was going to come? It was just a matter of time. So, you know, you've got really very recent and painful examples of what can happen. Go ahead.
Oh, and there's a certain weather amnesia. People think that the weather that we've seen in the last 10 years is so terrible. Well, we haven't had a major hurricane strike the U.S. literally since 2005. And if you go back to the 1950s and 1930s, the weather, the floods, the droughts, the hurricanes were much worse. And so we sort of suffer from a collective weather amnesia.
I think there's a general amnesia on the part of lots of us. When I, you know, someone in one of my business groups the other day said, you know, now's the time to get your fuel efficient car because all the gas guzzlers are flying out of our dealership because the price of gas is so low. And I'm thinking, I really don't drive a fuel efficient car based solely on the price of gas. I'm hoping I'm reducing my carbon emissions. I'm like, really? Did people forget what can happen for this? So let's just kind of, I think the whole interview could be taking piece by piece the other firestorm you set off, which I just cracked up and I thought, I love this person. And I'm barely kidding. So you wrote an op-ed piece for the Wall Street Journal in October of 2014 called The Global Warming Statistical Meltdown. And if it's okay with you, I'd like to go through some of the issues that you brought up, because for me, I have to tell you, after 7 years of being Mrs. Green, it created a lot of cognitive dissonance in me from what we're being fed by the press, what I call the mass media. And you kind of challenged, I'd say that you did challenge, the UN secretary, who warned without significant cuts in emissions by all countries in key sectors, the window of opportunity to stay within less than 2 degrees of warming will soon close forever. Well, how do you think that makes someone like me feel, who is not you and doesn't know all that you know? So what was your response to that?
Well, first off, I didn't, the statistical meltdown title.
You didn't do it.
That wasn't mine. That was the Wall Street Journal
editor. I saw that in your blog. It's like, I did not come up with that title. Thank you very much.
It's clever. It got the article a lot of attention, but I didn't come up with the title.
Exactly.
The issue is there is so many uncertainties in what the UN Secretary General is saying. I mean, and he's saying it with such absolute, catastrophe is on, is imminent. And it's just, apart from the issue of how fast the Earth is going to warm, the other issue is, what is dangerous? We still have nobody's really identified any species that have gone extinct because of human-caused climate change. People haven't been able to attribute any kind of an increase in extreme weather events to climate change, but the climate models project that all this is going to happen. Well, the climate models are running too hot, and that was sort of the main theme of my Wall Street Journal op-ed, is that there's pretty compelling evidence now that the climate models have just been running too hot. And they're projecting warming that just is not supported by the observations. And that was the gist of my walls. And so I was saying that, well, yeah, I mean, eventually we're going to warm, but how much and how fast, we still don't really know. And the current evidence is that it's not happening very quickly. So we have time to try to understand what's going on, to figure out what kind of policies make sense and develop new technologies that can really help us deal with this. So it's this sort of urgent action needed that I'm saying is not justified, that I think we do have time to try to figure out how to understand this better and how to deal with it in sensible ways.
And when you take on someone like the Secretary General of the UN in a very respectful and, to me, fact-based way, you know, you're asking for us to consider that the need for drastic reductions is less urgent. And the thought that I had is, I don't have to worry about my grandchildren burning up and dying without water, which is not, it's kind of hyperbole, but a lot of times you read these reports and you think, we're done. Like, we are literally, our goose is cooked on a high oven. So it to me, it was a very valid point. What about the part of when you talked about dangerous human interference and the Earth temperatures being warmed, what did the scientists, did they come out after you when you put this article out there, and say, what would the scientists who, you don't have to name names, but your biggest detractors say, oh my God, she is so wrong, and here's what I have to say about that? Does that question make sense? Why would they?
Yeah. Yeah. They didn't really, there were no serious scientific rebuttals to
that's
what
great.
I said.
I mean, that's great.
But they called me names. Okay. as a result of, now they're saying Curry advocates for inaction.
Great. So they did name calling.
I mean, how do
that's
you twist what
good.
I've said into advocating for inaction? I didn't say we shouldn't do anything. And now they're calling me a delayer, not a denier. They've been calling me a denier. Now they're calling me a delayer, you know, that it's okay to delay action, which is, I'm not saying we should do nothing. I have never said we should
ever,
do nothing.
In anything I read.
Okay, I'm just saying that thinking that there's a simple silver bullet solution to this very complex problem that we don't really understand is rather naive and misguided. So we need to work harder to try to understand this and to come up with better solutions and better technologies. And try not to think that both the problem and the solution are irreducibly global. I mean, look at the regional challenges and try to deal with those in a sensible way. If you're in Arizona, you're being faced with very different issues than, say, people in the Northeast U.S. and in Bangladesh and wherever else. And so trying to deal with the regional issues related to climate variability, floods and droughts, and whatever kind of hazards might be facing them, dealing with those in a sensible way, to me, will reduce our vulnerability to whatever climate change, whether it's human or natural, might throw at us. So that, to me, is a sensible approach.
And it focuses on the change that we all acknowledge is that we have more people on the planet and will have more people on the planet that will be impacted. So what do we do to put in, you know, forethought and projections and actions that will help what's going to impact them? And like you said, in the Southwest, we have a drought, and in Buffalo, they have 8 feet of snow. So we're not dealing with the same issues. And believe it or not, we have to come up to our first break. And when we come back, I'd like to talk more about some of the optimistic projections. Are there any? And should we all be focusing on the dangerous levels? You have very respected bodies of scientists, the International Panel on Climate Change, that that's really questioning some of the what I call the gloom and doom. So everybody, I certainly hope you'll stay here with me. That felt like about 2 minutes in our first 20-minute segment. I don't know about you, but I'm like, what? So stay with us, Dr. Judith Curry, a professor and former chair of the School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the Georgia Institute of Technology and president and co-owner of Climate Forecast Application Network, CFAN. We'll be right back to hear more from the climate heretic. Hi there, this is Mrs. Green with some pretty impressive news about the VW Jetta TDI. It's got a turbocharged clean diesel engine, it's 90% cleaner than previous diesel engines, it gets 609 miles on one tank of gas, more than the Prius. That's from Tucson, Arizona to San Diego and halfway back. And it's got an amazing 6-speed Tiptronic transmission. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI or visit ChapmanTucson.com.
For almost 40 years, Bookman's Entertainment Exchange has been the place for used books, music, movies, and video games in Arizona. From the latest bestsellers to out-of-print classics, we have you covered with 3 Tucson locations. And now you can buy, sell, and trade musical instruments. Our newly expanded sections are chock-full of top-notch instruments. From beginners to seasoned musicians, we've got something for you. Open 7 days a week, shop, hang out, and enjoy our free Wi-Fi. Bookman's, good for your pocket, good for the planet.
Ready to clean out that garage? Goodwill offers you 40 convenient locations all over southern Arizona. And at every one, you'll be greeted by a uniformed Goodwill employee trained to assist you in unloading your items, prepared to offer you a receipt for your tax-deductible donation, and grateful for something you won't get anywhere else.
Thank you. Because of your donation, I have a job.
The gift of Goodwill. For a list of Goodwill donation sites, go to goodwillsouthernaz.org.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And I want to do a quick shout out to invite you to consider becoming a sustaining member of Mrs. Green's World. What your support will do is help keep our broadcasts free and independent. And the translation for that is no one will ever own what I say, because Mrs. Green is not for sale. And if you want to continue to have me bring you informative shows like this one, addressing issues that impact all of our lives, please consider going to our website at mrsgreensworld.com, click on the Preserve Our Planet icon in the upper right-hand corner, and become a sustaining member. We are like the NPR of the internet, and I hope I don't get in trouble for saying that. And we have a great app that I want to invite new listeners to download. It's free. It's called Igloo Radio. It's on our website. And then you can take shows like this and listen and re-listen. Our guest today is Dr. Judith Curry, and she is a professor and former chair of the School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Why can't I get that right? I want to start over. It's because I want to get on with the show. The School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the Georgia Institute of Technology and president and co-owner of Climate Forecast Applications Network. She is known for her work on hurricanes, Arctic dynamics, and other climate-related topics. She is not only known as the climate heretic, she has new names that she's being called: the climate delayer, the climate denier, and in my opinion, the climate peacemaker. So again, thank you, Judith, for taking the time, and we are having fun. I hope you're having fun.
Oh, yeah, this is great.
Okay. So let's talk about the gloom and doom versus any optimistic projections. When you're talking about the levels that might never be reached, is that within the realm of your thinking and possibility that we're looking at extremes and pessimism? And there is some reason for optimism. Give us some hope here.
Okay, well, the issue is this. All other things being equal, if we keep adding more and more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, the climate will warm. But how much and on what time scale is still being debated. I think it's really more of a, you know, centuries kind of issue rather than some sort of CO2 control knob on our, you know, short-term climate. the ocean circulations and solar variations are, in my opinion, more important controls on the climate, you know, on decadal and multi-decadal timescales, which is mostly what, you know, we're going to worry about in terms of policies. So, you know, the IPCC and the climate models made a projection, you know, for substantial amounts of warming, although they admit right. significant uncertainty. But in the 2007 report, they anticipated for the first few decades of the 21st century that there would be 0.2 of a degree centigrade per decade warming, you know, for the first few decades.
Right.
And that, so in 20 years, you know, we're talking like something like almost a half a degree Fahrenheit. And there hasn't been any statistically significant warming since 1998. So
the projection. And who thinks that? I mean, that is not what the general thought pattern is out there. It's like we are frying. Do you agree with me? I mean, the mass media, either they're denying it in a very small percentage or saying literally.
Well they talk, okay, you know that they no longer talk about global warming. They talk about climate change.
Right, which is kind of, to me, it's progress.
I mean, because there's, I mean, the warming just hasn't been there for the last.
It's progress.
Yeah. So, yeah, climate changes and varies all the time, you know. El Niños and La Niñas and other modes of variability, and the sun seems to be headed into a relatively cool phase also. So there's a lot of other things going on right now that are dominating over anything related to human-caused greenhouse effect.
Right.
And scientists are scrambling, you know, to understand that and sort it out, and they've come up with all sorts of hypotheses and explanations, but it's still being debated. I think the main issue is really related to the oceans, the multi-decadal ocean circulation patterns. Which
and
is
what
really,
does that mean? You have to describe that to us because,
okay.
You know what I mean?
Well the oceans don't move so fast,
right.
and they can, it's fairly deep, and there's a long-term overturning circulation where water sort of sinks in the high latitudes and flows and whatever, and it's a slow process of all this water, you know, moving around, and so sometimes the circulations contribute to surface warming, and
right.
sometimes the surface cooling. The El Niño and the La Niña events, I think, are shorter-term examples of this, but those kind of circulation patterns happen on much longer time scales also. So I think this is what we're seeing. We're seeing shifts. We saw a big shift in the Pacific Ocean circulations, you know, that have happened
right.
over the past decade that I think is responsible for a lot of what we're seeing. And this is fundamentally tied on into what goes on at the high latitudes of the Atlantic Ocean. It's all connected. So scientists are trying to sort that out, but my hypothesis is that's what's really been driving the weather patterns and the lack of warming, you know, over the last 17 or so years. But when you hear about, have you heard about that the deep oceans are heating?
Yes.
Of course, it's still warming, but the heat is being hidden in the deep oceans. Well, that's an interesting idea, except prior
to 2000.
Yeah, except prior to 2005, we didn't really have any network of observations of the deep oceans.
So it just blows
we don't
me
know
away.
What's natural variability and
right.
what's human caused. And so there's really no particular observational evidence that there's anything going on in the deep ocean that's unusual. And even if the deep ocean is storing heat, it's very hard, once that heat gets mixed up, it's very hard to bring that back. I mean, if you mix a glass of cold water and hot water and mix it together and then try to get back the hot water. Well,
good luck with
can't
that.
Do it.
Right.
So the mixing sort of precludes getting back that heat. So, yeah, we need to understand that a whole lot better. But categorically saying, well, the deep oceans are heating. That's where the missing heat is going. That's why the surface isn't heating. Well, that's just a little more than a guess because we don't have the observational support.
It's, if you said 2005, there's not really any long-term longitudinal studies about what's really going to happen.
About the deep ocean below,
You use a term, climate sensitivity, and what exactly does that mean? What's the definition of climate sensitivity in what I call, human speak, not science speak?
Okay, so the equilibrium climate sensitivity is if you double the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Yes.
And then you let the Earth's climate equilibrate.
Right. Got it.
So the climate models say that would be about 3.5 degrees centigrade.
Right. Okay.
Okay. Now the transient climate response is if you, what is the 70-year response? The more transient response, and the climate models say more like 2 degrees centigrade. And the theme of my Wall Street Journal op-ed was related to trying to assess climate sensitivity over the last 150 years, from the observations. Okay, and we came up with climate sensitivity the equilibrium climate sensitivity that was about half of what the climate model showed.
Wow.
And in terms of the transient climate response, it was about maybe 70% of what the climate model showed. So we found, again, it's just more evidence that the climate models are running too hot. So is our method of doing, the observations are imperfect. We tried to assess the uncertainties associated with all the different, observations that went into our study. So there's an envelope of uncertainty around what we came up with, but it's still nothing close to what the climate models are producing.
Right. What I call the burning up model. And, is it really related to, I know you and another colleague, and I think you call him Nick in one of the articles, Nicholas Lewis, published a study in climate dynamics. And, I make a joke about this is way above my pay grade. I'm a great interviewer. I do great research. I have a wonderful team. And this was a complex one for me to get my head around. And I think I understand a little bit more than the average, man on the street. But what were you talking about, the transient climate response? And there's two parts to my question. What it means, and should it matter to us? And I mean us. I make the distinction because people say to me all the time, tell me what that means in English. Tell me what that means not in science talk. So when you're writing about a complex issue, transient climate response, is there a piece of this, a crystal you can pick out for us that we really need to think about and understand? Because that's what I want our listeners to get from all of the incredible work you've done.
Okay, well, the transient climate response is more relevant for us than the equilibrium climate response.
Okay.
The equilibrium climate response take a couple of centuries, where the transient climate response is defined in the context of 70 years.
Okay. I understand that. It's like, that's English.
Okay.
So,
now the issue is whether this 1.3 degrees centigrade or a little over 2 degrees Fahrenheit, does that amount of warming matter?
Right.
Well, that's something that I don't get into as a scientist. I mean, I don't publish, does that 2.5 does that matter? I just assess other people's arguments. To me, we can only look to the past and see, well, we saw this kind of temperature change in the past, you know, a degree? Did it matter? Well, we've seen about a degree, you know, since about 1880, and the world didn't end. In fact, it's probably a nicer climate now than it was in the late 19th century when we were coming out of a little ice age. So, you know, is warm good or bad? There's no simple answer to that. And people say, well, it's what you've adapted to, what you're used to. Well, there's a certain element of that. And then they say, oh, but sea level rise.
Right.
Well, see, you know,
California is disappearing. You hear that. And New Jersey's going to be underwater. So my daughter lives in L.A., and I'm like, you should buy property in Yuma.
Yeah. Okay, now the issue with sea level rise. Sea level rise has been rising for the last 10,000 years,
right,
since the last ice age. Okay, and for the last 400 years, we've seen an acceleration, a little bit of it was really fast coming out of the ice age, then we saw it slow down, and now, say, for the last 400 years, we've seen it speed up a little bit, between about 2 or 3 millimeters per year. I mean, a millimeter is tiny, tiny, tiny. But the issue is how much of that is natural versus how much of that can be blamed on humans.
Right.
And people say, oh, we've seen a spike in the 90s. Oh, my gosh. Well, that spike in the 90s is about as big as the spike we saw around 1940. Okay? We can't blame that one on humans. So how do we interpret that? To me, it looks like natural variability. But we don't know. But even if you look at sea level rise, if you look at locally, you know, this two or three millimeters per year, and if you look at what the observed sea level rise is at certain locations, say in New Orleans, it's about 3 or 4 times bigger than that 2 or 3 millimeters per year. And so something else is going on there. I mean, that's caused by land use, geological subsidence, the way they've engineered the Mississippi River. It's not humans. And most places, if you look where you look, where there's substantial sea level rise, there's something else going on there besides human-caused global warming that's causing the sea level rise. So thinking that we're going to fix like New Orleans sea level rise problem or Bangladesh sea level rise problem. In fact, for Bangladesh, global warming is estimated to contribute only maybe 10% of what's going on there. So trying to solve local sea level rise problems by not burning fossil fuels isn't going to really help, because that's really only, you know, at most a small contributor to most places sea level rise.
And so, I think the case can be made that trying to reduce them in an amount of time that will help the people in Bangladesh is really arguable. And I want to ask you something about the integration of thought, that I call it, including other factors in the discussion, because I've had scientists on that study the oceans. I've had scientists on that talk about overfishing. What about things like, when you say human-caused, what about how many more airplanes we have flying over our oceans? You know, there's jet fuel. There's that piece where we didn't have that even 50 years ago. So what about the impact, and I mean as it relates specifically to disappearing species in the oceans, and I watched a special on PBS about the weird algae, the fungus that the starfish are getting. I don't want, you know, you're not the expert on ocean warming. You don't claim to be. But how do you factor that into just your thought process of human-caused it's pollution? I mean, there's just
oh,
more
yeah.
activity.
Oh, yeah. In terms of the ocean problems, I mean, they're mostly in coastal regions.
Right.
You know, where there's runoff, you know.
Horrible things happening. Exactly.
Yeah, and people dumping things in oceans. So, yeah, the pollution problem is a lot harder on ocean than anything that we're doing. You know, the temperature fluctuations in the oceans and the pH fluctuations in the ocean are, you know, relatively minor, and if a species doesn't like it, they very quickly, you know, move around. But that they seem to be, you know, from what I've read, seem to be fairly tolerant to, you know, to variability. So I think pollution, you know, the kind of stuff where you dump something into the water is really a bigger issue.
It's a whole nother conversation, which sometimes the climate change conversation detracts from. Because it would hold some really big dogs accountable for what they're doing.
Exactly. And here's what this is. By focusing only on emissions and CO2, it's an opportunity loss when we could be focusing on other things that are actually going to make the environment better. Even if you talked about on our sort of lifetime, even if you believe the climate models and were actually effective in reducing emissions, it would be the end of the 21st century where we would be able to separate.
Okay, we're going to have to take another quick break.
Noise.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but we have to take another quick break. We'll be right back. I'm hanging on your every word, and I'm sure our listeners are too. Stay with us for more from Dr. Judith Curry, the Climate Heretic.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Glimmerglass Radio Networks. If you have questions about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World next.
Think blue. Think beyond green. Think TDI clean diesel technology. One part of the Volkswagen Think Blue initiative, our goal of creating and encouraging eco-conscious products and behaviors. This is Mrs. Green. A car that can drive a long way should still make you want to, well, drive a long way. Volkswagen Jetta's TDI clean diesel is a high-mileage vehicle that lets you stop at the filling station less often so you can spend more time enjoying the road. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI.
The Habit Store is a big operation with staff and volunteers working hard to reduce our carbon footprint. We sell donated building materials, furniture and appliances, and recycle the metal from items that we can't repair or sell. We even have solar panels on the roof. The good deals we offer shoppers means Tucson Habitat can build and renovate homes for hardworking people. The Habit Store's store hours are Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, Saturdays, 8 to 4, and you'll find us on Grant Road, just east of I-10 in Tucson, Arizona.
Everybody, you're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And I hope you're enjoying this opportunity to think with me and because of our guest. Her name is Dr. Judith Curry, and she is a professor and former chair of the School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the Georgia Institute of Technology and president and co-owner of Climate Forecast Applications Network, also known as CFAN. And Judith, we're going to have you back. This should have been a two-part series because we're you know, my board op and I are listening and not even realizing the time is going by and missing the cues that we have to go off air for a minute. So that's when you know you have a really good show and our listeners are going to be as excited as I am about hearing what you have to say. And let's pick up on the thread about the oceans, and you do have the whole idea. I love that idea of we need to focus on other things besides climate change, aka global warming, aka the earth heating up, to start focusing putting the spotlight a little bit on some of the real issues of pollution in the ocean. That's a whole nother conversation that man can control. Agreed?
Yeah, you know, everyone would agree that we don't want to trash the oceans or the environment,
right,
you know, unnecessarily. And it's a relatively easy one to fix. You know, it's problems, you know, dealing with challenges like that, that it's a lot easier to developed, you know, political agreement on, where the benefits are more tangible and the costs aren't overwhelming.
Right. But the fight will be really like pit bulls. Because corporations, I mean, it's what I cover a lot. There's the bottom line, there's earnings per share, there is the actual issue of where are we going to put all of the massive waste that we're producing as a planet. So it is definitely another conversation.
Oh, yeah, trying to focus on that problem, to me, is more meaningful than trying to reduce carbon dioxide emissions.
Could not agree with you more. I mean, it's like we better get a handle on this one because people want their oysters. It's like when you bring it home to their menu. So I have to, in the fun part of the show, when you publish the paper in Climate Dynamics, did the scientific community come up with more names like outlier, or are you, you know, I just see you now as someone just going, putting like little matches on cancer kerosene.
Okay, well, I have to tell you a story, though, about my co-author, Nick Lewis.
Love it.
Nick Lewis is a semi-retired financier who lives in the UK, who was skeptical of climate change and has taken up climate change as a hobby. He's not an academic or anything like that.
Right,
I think he's published about a half a dozen journal articles at this point. So this is one of the skeptics that I started talking with. Okay, and we actually developed a meaningful scientific collaboration that resulted in a high-impact paper. And so there's been the whole climate gate issue, if you recall that, with the hacked, you know, hiding the decline and all that. That came from, you know, a war between some of the establishment climate scientists involved in the IPCC and these skeptics in the blogosphere who were busy auditing and checking their work and challenging their work.
Right.
And, you know, I said, okay, well, some of these groups are really quite bright and they have very good statistical and mathematical capabilities. And, you know, I started engaging with them. And, like, the most visible result is this paper that Nick Lewis and I published together. So there are valuable resources in the broader community outside of academia who are contributing to the analysis of data and checking the work of other scientists and are making very valuable contributions. Again, there's a lot of noise, but there's some real signal out there coming from what I would call the non-academic skeptical blogosphere community.
And, you know, to me, regardless of which side on which you choose to weigh in, the skeptic or the believer or somewhere in the middle, what I loved about having you on the show is that your argument is let's sit down and talk to them and hear what they have to say and have a conversation. Let's have civil conversation because, you know what, when I was reading it, it's like this impacts me. And I'm counting on and trusting well-respected scientists and platforms to speak, like, for example, the head of the UN, to trust. I want to trust what they say. And what you said is, instead of just name-calling, let's sit down and have a conversation. What are the facts they're coming up with? Are they valid? And can we write them? I mean, I know it sounds a little bit on the, you know, the preachy side, and I don't mean to be. I want to say this is what my show is about. We want you to think, not tell you what to. So how can we know what to think if we're not listening to the other side? So that's my little diatribe on what.
Well, that's an important point. And
it is.
You know, in science, you know, challenging the establishment is sort of skepticism. It's one of the norms of science. I mean, physicists are still arguing about quantum mechanics, but all of a sudden, with a relatively recent and complex topic like climate change, we're, you know, not allowed to disagree with the consensus. I mean, scientifically, it's just ludicrous. So
it's counterintuitive to start challenging.
And it's the insistence. You know, if they would have not insisted on this manufacturing a consensus around this subject, I think there would be a lot less, it'd be a lot less contentious. Okay, well, there's two sides to this, and let's, okay, this is what we think, and this is what the other guys think. You know, let's figure out what we should do about it. And you don't need to fight this silly war over the science because it's so uncertain. And privately, the scientists will mostly acknowledge that, but in their public statements, you know, and you know, they're so dogmatic.
And it is a war. I don't think that's hyperbole at all. I mean, a friend of mine that lives here in Tucson is Jonathan Overpeck, who got a Nobel Peace Prize for his work. And you should hear him talk about it. And he talked about it on the show, that he got death threats, that he got his, all of his emails were, you know, taken from him, his privacy, his family. It was a war. It was an invasive war that really affected his personal life and his family. I mean, it wasn't just about a debate on the floor of the UN.
Oh, right, right. And people,
it was
on both sides.
Exactly.
People on both sides have been subject to that. You know, what, one side claiming victim, that doesn't really fly because both sides have been subject to it.
Right. And it's really, when you talk about it, I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, really? They're name calling? They've come up with all these names for you, which translates to me, there's a lot that we should be thinking about. Because when you resort to that in your personal life, you've run out of all your good weapons. It's like, okay,
exactly.
I'm going to start calling
you. Don't have
names.
Any good arguments. You just,
yes.
You know, name call.
Right. You're a jerk. It's really, it's very true. It sounds oversimplified, but it's really very true. So part of what I'd love to talk about in the very rapidly disappearing time that we have is it's a lot for us to take in. And I say, I represent the common man. What should we be concerned about? Are there sound bites or snippets or whatever I say, things that we should be at the very least reading more about and educating ourselves more about? Because that's who my tribe is. People that want to know more and to know better is to do better. They're listening to these podcasts so that they can continue to understand complex issues and have an opinion about them.
Well, I really appreciate what you're doing, you know, with your show and your approach. I really like it. This is why I started my blog, Climate Etc., judithcurry.com.
It's really good, everybody. judithcurry.com. It's really good.
And it's pitched at not what I would call the knee-jerk kind of people, but people who want to think, who have at least a little bit of technical education, or at least are prepared to read things that are, or not mathematical, but you know, who are prepared to spend the time dealing with technical issues. But I don't just talk about the science. I talk about the social psychology of science.
Yes.
I talk about challenges at the interface between science and policy, you know, things like that. So, and the politicization and the new technologies and challenges with the energy grid and things like that. So we talk about a whole host of issues related to climate change. And so, and I think it's pretty accessible to people. So I encourage people that there's a number of blogs out there and people on Twitter who are also pointing to interesting articles. So find, you know, several diverse sources of information, you know, and follow and try to make sense out of it. And if you're confused, well, that's rather the point. Anybody who isn't confused about this
that's what
really
I call cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
You know, one of these days, my team and I talk about it all the time, we're going to film me getting ready for a show and have somebody listening in, because I really do prepare for the shows, and I hope it's reflective of that in the conversations we've had, the questions I've asked you. So I'm getting ready for the show, and I'm saying, there is no way I can do this in an hour. What the heck do we do? We should have made, and I'm talking out loud to myself, by myself, saying, I'm never going to be able to do this. How can I crystallize all this woman is making us, inviting us, giving us the ability to think about in 58 minutes. So that's my invitation for part two with Judith Curry.
Oh, wow.
And
that,
I think
no,
people
this is great.
Are,
I mean, and this is an audience. One of the challenges for me is, and now I've been pigeonholed, where my only invites tend to be...
That's so wrong.
Skeptical.
It's so
they don't tend to be. They don't tend to be the green groups, if you will.
Right.
So this is good for me to try to reach a group that I don't normally reach.
And I really hope you do, because I can tell you what I would be. I am. My first show when I was on Clear Channel was called Mrs. Green Goes Mainstream. And it was fun and frivolous, and you know, what if living green could be fun? And you can't authentically walk the walk I've walked and not make it more complicated. So I have learned and evolved. And what people now ask me is, well, what's your opinion on this? And I look at them kind of like deer in the headlights, and I say, you know what? It's complicated. Everybody wants, here's what you should think about that. And even with GMOs, I want to be, they are bad, they are this, they are that. Well, that's a complicated issue too. And I had a scientist on at the beginning of the year, and it's like, this guy was a lead scientist on genetic research in the 60s. It's not a simple issue. You know, it's easy for me to really hate Monsanto, and I'm very clear about that, but I have a lot of other good reasons when you talk about, you know, deploying pesticides to our Mississippi shores. They would get the guilty verdict for me, but that's not specifically about the issue of genetically modifying a seed. So there I went off again. But let's really repeat again for people that listen. I have scientists that listen to my show when they're jogging. Go to judithcurry.com, follow you on Twitter. And is it Curry IA? Is that what it is?
No, it's Curry JA.
Curry JA. Okay. And we'll get that right when we, you know, do our social media about the show. Our team is really sharp in doing that. And I get to go off on tangents, and they get to love it or leave it. You know what I mean? So the crystal eyes thought, let's lead with that. What does Dr. Judith Curry, whose names I won't repeat that you're being called, say? What do you want people to do? Check out your blog, look a little deeper, and don't have your mind made up. I mean, am I paraphrasing you right? Go into it with an open mind.
Just the takeaway is we've oversimplified the problem and the solution. It's very complex, and we need to broaden the dialogue about both and develop new policy options, including ones that are more locally centric, to try to help us deal with the challenges related to climate variability and change.
And I'm actually trying to write it down so we can put quotes like that up on Twitter. We have oversimplified the solutions?
The problem and the solution.
The problem and the solution. I mean, that's a really great Twitter tease. I got that out. And you know, when you do come back, and I will talk to Kelly about inviting you to come back, we didn't even touch on what you're doing with CFAN. And we didn't touch on a lot of in your writing is there are major implications in the area of public policy for what statements are being made, what bold statements are. And as a voter, as a very active voter at the local level, the state level, the national level, I want people to not tell me what to think. I want them to give me things to think, because it is going to affect my vote. And I want it to be based on hearing both sides of the argument and then making up my own mind. You know, don't feed me the Kool-Aid. That's how I feel.
Exactly.
That's a really horrible analogy from way long ago. But
yeah.
It's like, I am not
old enough to understand that analogy.
I know. It's really sad when I talk about, when I sing the line from Cheers, you know, sometimes you want to go, everybody knows your name, and kids look at me and are like, what? I mean, you don't know the tagline, the song from Cheers, and they're really glad you came. So will you come back, and what are some of the things that we didn't cover that you would like to? How's that for putting you on the spot? But you're a troublemaker and a delayer and a denier, so you must have more things
Okay, it's how to approach decision making under deep uncertainty.
Oh my God, I want to be. Okay. I can play the show back and hear that. Yeah,
yeah, and that's a key issue. You know, people think that you have to have a silver bullet solution or do nothing. Well, there's a whole host of other options
in between.
That you want things that make sense no matter what, how the climate plays out. And one of the issues and related to my company, CFAN, is we look at how shorter term weather and climate information can be used to reduce vulnerability and profitability.
I
would like to see a lot more emphasis rather than these long-term climate models that just don't work, and I don't see a path for tweaking them. I don't see an easy fix.
Well, I want to have you back.
Why not focus on the shorter term stuff?
Short term, because in my lifetime, that gives me hope. Everybody, I hope you enjoyed as much as I did. Tuesday, Sharon Sarton, Scraps to Straps. Next Saturday, Philip Vanini, Off the Grid, a book about people who have literally gone off the grid. Judith Curry, thanks for showing up in Mrs. Green's World.